quite a bit. And this is such a huge story in Boston, but I don't see it getting as big a play throughout the country. Why do you think that is?
We're baffled by it as well. I mean, I think it's the most serious. It's probably the worst scandal in FBI history. In a sense, it goes to their core function. They're supposed to apprehend the bad guys, not be silent partners with them, particularly for as long as 20 years. Now, the other stories about them not turning over information to McVeigh for his defense and the excessive force at Ruby Ridge and Waco, they don't go to the core function of and what you expect from the FBI. But the FBI got addicted to the notion that informants are the way to go. And Whitey Bulger was a very clever, crafty guy who knew how to exploit that tendency in the Bureau.
Your story is about the partnership, in a sense, between FBI agent John Connolly and Whitey Bulger, who both came from Southie.
Yeah, they both grew up in the same tenement in South Boston, the Old Harbor housing project. Bulger's about 10 years older than Connolly, but Connolly was clearly, an aura of Whitey Bulger is from the time he was in short pants. And Whitey Bulger was the infamous hellion in the tenements.
Maybe you can explain to our audience, how do both of these people use their relationships in order to further each other's cause?
Well, it certainly was a synergistic partnership. It was the key to success for John Connolly within the Bureau. Informants, particularly in the early 70s, is when he started, with a way to travel up the ladder. You have to go back in time a little bit to the early 70s when getting the Italian mafia was the holy grail for the Bureau. And Connolly realized that. Clarence Kelly, who was the FBI director, said, without informants, we're nothing. And it was clearly the road to success. Where it went awry is that you've got to have arm's length dealings. You can't have two boyhood acquaintances and leave them out in the cold for 20 years and expect to get anything like measured management. What you have very quickly in this case is they're both feathering each other's nest. Now, how deep and dirty it went, I think it remains to be seen. John Connolly's boss, a man named John Morris, who was the head of the organized crime squad, has admitted in testimony that he took $7,000 in bribes from Bulger. And he only met with Bulger 10 to 15 times over a 10-year period. Connolly was clearly a friend and a business partner. I mean, he's charged with being in the rackets with Bulger now. So I think the sky's the limit as to how deep and dirty that went.
Gerard, there was always the myth that Whitey Bulger was a protector of Southie and that he was only giving up the Italian mob.
Right. That's really the, I think that's the ultimate betrayal in all this, because Bulger was, with Connolly working the media, was able to present himself as the Robin Hood of South Boston, who delivered turkeys on holidays, and he was a tough guy in a brutal world, but he only was as violent as he had to be to survive. And the truth is, he's a homicidal maniac. He was killed of at least 20 people, and, and poured cocaine all over the housing projects. I mean, one of his most lucrative sources of money for at least 10 years was the tice that had to be paid him by drug dealers working in South Boston.
Now, Jared, what information was Whitey Bulger giving to the FBI, and what information was the FBI giving to Whitey Bulger?
Well, Bulger was ratting out rivals on the Irish turf. I mean, it was... And Connolly was always able to say, in a bogus way, that Bulger helped the FBI bring down the Italian mafia. Bulger almost had nothing to do with that. His partner in crime, a man named Stephen Fleming, who did have access to the Italians, because he was Italian, I mean, the mafia disliked and distrusted Bulger, but they did smile on Stevie Fleming, and he did give them... He did give the FBI some information about the Italians that was helpful. But Bulger basically was ratting out his own. And that's sort of the stand-up Southie guy who's loyal to his friends and tough with his enemies. I mean, that is the ultimate betrayal here. And both Conley and Bulger were able to exploit an instinct deep within both their institutions, the FBI and South Boston, and that is to circle the wagons against outside criticism. We did some stories revealing Bulger as an informant 13 years ago, and South Boston spit it out, and it was spun as more just criticism and propaganda from the liberal media. And it's taken a good long time, and the bodies piled up to the rafters, but I think Whitey Bulger name is now finally mud in South Boston.
I'm just reading, and there is a tradition within the Irish community about the hatred of informers. I mean, there's movies about it. And I'll just read a quick paragraph, and this is from John Red Shea. He says, "I hate effing rats," John Red Shea complained. "They're just as bad as rapists and effing child molesters. And what would he do if he found an informant? I tie him to a chair, okay? Then I take a baseball bat, and I take the best swing across his effing head, and I watch the head come off his shoulders. Then I take a chainsaw and cut his effing toes off. I'll talk to you later, sweetheart." This was him talking to his girlfriend that they had on tape. Now, how did Bulger justify, with everybody in Southie hating informants, having a tradition of hating informants, and him being one of the biggest informers probably within the Irish community ever had in South Boston?
Well, that was the secret. I mean, it was almost inconceivable. It was just about unthinkable that Whitey Bulger, the ultimate stand-up Southie guy, the ultimate tough guy, would have any truck with law enforcement. And that's why it was so pernicious and lasted so long, because nobody would have ever suspected it. In fact, when some of his handlers in the FBI began to worry because the state police had kind of doped out that Bulger was a protected informant by the Bureau. I mean, Bulger, in meetings with the FBI higher-ups, said, "Look, no one's going to believe that. Don't worry about it. Let me worry about it. It's my territory. I know these people. No one's going to believe this, so don't worry ahead about it."
Now, you say that he was protected by the FBI. What happened when the state police and the Boston police tried to get on to Whitey and from his racketeering activities?
Well, you know, they had the state police said by accident bumped into Bulger's base of operations, which was a garage in the west end of Boston. And they saw what the real deal was in the underworld. It was, on a selective basis, a joint enterprise between Italian mafia leadership and Whitey Bulger and Stevie Fleming. And they were in the process of putting electronic bugs into the garage, which would have caught them red-handed doing their joint ventures with gambling and loan sharking and drugs. And the FBI found out that the state police were targeting Bulger, and they wanted him. And there's even a possibility now that a state trooper tipped them off, too. I mean, when Steve Fleming talked about this in court, he said they got it from three or four different sources that the state police were working on them. So, you know, the state police, after that project blew up and Bulger stopped going into his office and they relocated, they knew what the deal was, that Bulger was indeed a protected FBI informant. And that was 1980. And the relationship between Bulger and the FBI went on for another 15 years until he was indicted. And he was only indicted when it took an outside prosecutor, a really tough, skilled guy from New Jersey who came into Boston, couldn't figure out why nobody was really targeting the ultimate and biggest gangster in town, and teamed up with the state police and avoided the FBI. That's the only way that Whitey Bulger ever really got prosecuted.
You're listening to Radio Free Aaron, and we're speaking about a book. It's in paperback now, The Black Mass, and with us, one of the writers, Jared O'Neill, and the other co-writer is Dick Lair. J- Jared, another interesting fact in your book is the tie-in with the Irish Republican Army. There was a ship that went out of Boston called the Valhalla, where it transferred weapons over to the Maria Ann, of which a prominent member of Sinn Féin now, Martin Ferris, who could be a member of the Irish government in the next general election, he was arrested and got 10 years. But there was a kid killed up in Boston in order to cover up some of the informants on both sides of the water. Maybe you could tell us about that case with McIntyre.
Well, you know, that's a complicated one to sort out, because the original proposition on that was that Whitey Bulger helped finance that and was a supporter of the IRA and only too happy to get them some armaments. And that's been revised a little bit because there's a notion now that Whitey Bulger may have even been an informant on that as well. But one of the worst instances of FBI dereliction in the 20 years of sorry history was what happened to a potential informant who was trying to provide information about Bulger's drug smuggling. And he was sort of on the lower ladders of the drug smuggling unit, and that was John McIntyre. And he began to talk with DEA agents and detectives from a city just south of Boston, Quincy, Massachusetts. And when it became known within the Bureau that McIntyre was giving information about Bulger's drug operation, within days, he disappeared. And it now turns out, because of of one of Bulger's principal lieutenants who has finally become a government witness, that John McIntyre was abducted, tortured, and murdered. And that happened in, I believe, 1984. And his body was recovered last fall on the basis of what information that was provided by one of Bulger's lieutenants, Kevin Weeks, who is now facing racketeering. He's cut his own deal with prosecutors.
But, Jared, there was also an informer at that stage in Ireland called Sean O'Callaghan.
That's right.
And they were saying that British intelligence was trying to put out that information leading to the arrest of everyone in this gun smuggling operation came from the American side and that it didn't come from the Irish side. So both sides were trying to protect their informants.
See, I've never been able to sort that out. You know, that there is an IRA agent, apparently, who has admitted that he played a role in diming out that operation. And there's also a notion that it could have been compromised on this side, and possibly that Whitey Bulger was involved in it. So I've never been able to really sort get to the bottom of it in my own mind. I just don't know what happened. It's a very complicated tale. But what's clear is that a young man who had seen the light and by all accounts was trying to do right and do the best by himself and his family wound up with a terrible death because of FBI collusion with Bulger.
I understand his family is now suing the FBI.
That's right. There's lots of suits piling up over this. Some other innocent victims are suing the agency as well.
Jared, there's a policy here within the New York City Police Department that you can't work out of the precinct that you were born and raised in that neighborhood, or actually where you live. You cannot live in the precinct that you're working. Does the FBI have any policy like that you cannot work in an area where you grew up and knew everyone, just like Connolly did? I mean, Connolly used it to his benefit for Bulger, but does the FBI have any policy of where they place their agents?
Well, you know, they're very strict about letting people go home because they do worry about the syndrome that's called going native. When an agent gets home, his friendships can interfere with his judgment. And that's obviously been a huge factor in this whole imbroglio. But how hard and fast that is I just don't know. I know now that there's been revisions of the guidelines on between agents and informants, where the new figure in the equation now is a high-level prosecutor. Because what was happening here in Boston is the prosecutors were cut out of the deals that the agents were making on the street. And all of a sudden they'd be trying to indict somebody, and the FBI would come to him and say, no, he's one of ours. And, you know, that wildly exceeded their authority. I mean, they just can't make those kind of unilateral decisions. So those are for prosecutors to make. So the big change, and again, it'll come down to, you know, really being enforced, is that prosecutors have to be factored into this arrangement and have to sign on. And I think that there'll be a much far limited duration now. They're not going to go on for 15 and 20 years. And prosecutors will have to assent to making somebody a top echelon informant for the Bureau now. The Bureau resisted that mightily, but they, under the circumstances, had to relent and agree to it.
Yeah, but Jared, over the years here in New York, we've had some of the top agents, say, working for the Federal Bureau of Narcotics out in Queens. They were from Woodside, and they were working at Jackson Heights. They weren't working against their own people. These were Irish Americans who were working against Colombians. Also, we had this thing that was called in New York the Joint Task Force. And one great story that came out of that was when they were looking for bodies in the tunnels. This was the railroad tunnels on the west side, supposedly where the Westies had a graveyard. They found so many bodies that they just put them on file. They said, well, we can use this in another case. We can use this in another case. And this was the time when the FBI was working with the New York City Police Department. But now it seems that the FBI has gone again. We did, just during the week, we see where the FBI, where another agent has fallen. He was given information on agents and witnesses and all this to the mafia. What the hell is happening with the FBI?
Well, I think it's that, you know, you have the problem with absolute power and no oversight and the ensuing arrogance that engenders. They've been reviewing their own activities, and it's kind of a predictable result. That the lack of oversight, I think, is, I mean, that's what they've been resisting here in the new tougher guidelines on what they can do with their informants. But I think that seems to be the only solution besides some congressional oversight that may come into play before it's over.
The other side of the Whitey Bulger story is his brother Billy, who's a very, very prominent politician in Massachusetts. What was the relationship between the brothers?
Well, they're very close. I mean, Bill Bulger makes no bones about that. He says he loves his brother, and he wishes him well. He has appeared before a grand jury in Boston fairly recently, and no one knows quite what the discussions were about, but I presume it would be, you know, whether he's had any contact with his brother and the disposition of some of his brother's money. So, and Bill Bulger, who is now president of the University of Massachusetts, was president of the Senate for 20 years. And he ruled it in a masterful way. I mean, he's a very gifted and very intelligent guy who has a great instinct for power. He handles himself very well on a public podium. He just did the eulogy for Congressman Joseph Moakley. So, I mean, he obviously took a different route to his prominence. But he did benefit from some of the same agents who were looking out for his brother Whitey, because his law partner, good 10 years ago, was accused of extorting money, and Billy had found to split it and get half of it. Now, his story at that time had been that the minute he found out the source of the money, which he said was a loan from his law partner, he repaid it post-haste because he figured that, he said that the money was tainted. We found records that had been compiled by federal prosecutors and reviewed by state prosecutors that Bill Bulger actually kept that money, and that's in the book. That's Chapter 14, and the chapter notes in Chapter 14 explain exactly how much was known about Bill Belger's role in that alleged extortion by his law partner. So he's not totally without criticism here.
Jared, like I said, I go back and forth to Boston quite a bit. There's a story about Whitey Bulger winning the lottery in Boston. And then some of the stories I heard that somebody owed him money and he shaked him down to get the ticket in order to win. Do you know any more about him winning the lottery or how that happened?
Well, I think the winner of the lottery ticket was the brother of one of Bulger's gang members. And there's no question that Whitey Bulger saw it as a way to get some legitimate income to cover his lifestyle, which was kind of minimal. He wasn't a flashy high liver. But it was, we get him $90,000 a year tax-free, and that could cover all his that could cover his lifestyle. And so the winner, I think it was like a $15 million ticket. He got to keep half of it, and the other half was split up three ways between Bulger and two of his associates. Now, there's been some backtracking about by the federal investigators on how that all came to pass, but I don't think there's much question that Whitey Bulger saw it as a cover for his lifestyle and keep the IRS away from his door.
Jared, we're going to have you on again. We're doing a tribute to the firefighters that were killed here in New York, and also to Carol O'Connor, who came from Queens.
Right.
But one final question here. The FBI seemed to be very good. The man who shot a doctor in upstate New York was found in France. The people who they said did the embassy bombing in Kenya and all around, they were brought in from Africa. We found Manuel Noriega in Panama, brought him to Florida. How is it that Whitey Bulger, who now has been on the run a couple of years, and the FBI, with all their resources, cannot find this man?
Well, it's a really good question. It's the longer it goes, the harder it is for the FBI to keep insisting that they're giving it their best effort. I mean, it's almost 7 years now since Whitey Bulger was indicted. And by the way, the FBI handler stands accused now of tipping him that the indictment was coming. Bulger did plan his escape very carefully. He took one of his girlfriends on a long, slow cruise around America in 1994 in anticipation of his indictment. And the supposition is that he was going to small banks and small cities in rural America and dropping off in safety deposit boxes, cash, and false identity papers. But that can only get you so far. And he really has lost his lifeline back into South Boston. His two principal lieutenants are now under indictment and now government witnesses. So he's a man without a country at the moment. And I think if they're waiting for him to make a mistake, they're going to wait a long time, because he is a very disciplined, very crafty guy. But still,
isn't it in their interest not to find him, because he could tell one hell of a story?
I think it really comes down. I don't see how catching him and what he'd have to say about the FBI could be any worse than the story that they're living with now. I think it's going to come down to public relations. It always does with the FBI, and I think there's more public relation damage to not catch him than to catch him at this point. It's just gone on too long, and they're looking foolish on top of looking corrupt.
But another one with some cojones is Connolly. He's doing television interviews.
Oh, sure.
He says he's innocent, that this was...
Well, his argument is that he's a scapegoat and that he's a real hero, and he used Bulger and Flemmy to bring down the entire Italian mafia. And he's very forceful, and he looks right into the camera, and he doesn't blink at all. I mean, he can fight the fight. But he's fighting against the evidence now. I mean, the evidence is really piling up all around him. I haven't heard from John Connolly in quite a few months now. His public relations offensive seems to have run its course.
Is he retired or?
He got a job at Boston Edison, which has always had a kind of a nexus with the FBI, and he started as head of security, and then his brand of blather, which is quite good, got him a job as one of their top lobbyists. And Boston Edison stuck with him for a surprising long time. And he was on their payroll on leave for a year after he was indicted. But he was indicted in December of 99 for racketeering, for leaking information to Bulger about informants and rival investigations. But it was a superseding indictment last fall in October, which charges him with obstruction of justice because he leaked information about rival informants like John McIntyre and Brian Halloran and others who came to a very sorry end because Whitey Bulger learned that they were trying to provide authorities with information about Whitey Bulger, and they all ended up dead. So Connally, once he got charged with that, he sort of disappeared from TV and radio, and Boston Edison finally cut him a retirement package, so he's no longer employed by the major utility here in town.
Jared, any chance of a movie on this?
Well, we're hoping. We had an option with Miramax, largely because Matt Damon and Ben Affleck were knowledgeable about South Boston. They did a major movie that was very successful for them in South Boston, Good Will Hunting. And they knew all the Whitey Bulger lore. That seems to have gone by the boards, so we're out there now seeing what we can do with that.
Well, good luck. The book is called Black Mass, The True Story of the Unholy Alliance Between the FBI and the Irish Mob, written by Dick Lair and Jared O'Neill of the Boston Globe. Jared, we'll have you on as this story develops and, you know...
Happy to do it.
As the chase continues for Whitey Bulger and the killers of O.J.'s wife.
Indeed.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
And you're listening to Radio Free Erin, and we're discussing that. Anybody who's been listening to Radio Free Erin knows there's another informant out in Chicago, David Rupert. And there'll be a story coming out tomorrow in the London Sunday Times. You'll be able to get it up on NewsHound, N-U-Z-H-O-U-N-D. BBC Ulster are out in Chicago now doing a film about David Rupert. And I would say when the book is written on that, it'll be every bit as interesting as this book called The Black Mass and everything that went on with David Rupert. Right now we're going to go to a little music. We'll come back. We're going to pay a little tribute to Carol O'Connor and his impact here in America as another Irish-American. And we'll be speaking to the one and only Malachy McCourt and also George Harrison, who knew the family pretty well. Yes, and then the camera would zoom in to a house on Cooper Avenue in Glendale, where I live about 10 blocks away from that famous block, of which now the King of Queens zoom in on Cooper's, which, funny enough, is one block away from where the start of All in the Family shoot, that one block in Queens. We're still trying to get Malachi McCourt. He's in the Upper West Side. Malachi, if you can hear us, call in. We are getting your machine. But we have with us on the line George Harrison. Carol O'Connor, of course, came from Queens, did a lot of his training over in Ireland, was a big supporter of WBAI. He used to send in thousands of dollars in through Radio Free Erin. And I have to tell you, we could kick ourselves out. We were supposed to have him in. He was in California when he was doing the book tour about his autobiography. And that is something that you just can't do. And, you know, we have to, anybody that's out there that we know, and the books are out, we have to do the interviews by saying, putting them off, well, Carol looks pretty good. You know, he's only 76. And then you get the news about what happens. But, George, you remember him in a different sort of vein. You remember him through the family and the newspaper they used to own. What was that?
The Irish Advocate. It was a 15-part roll. And I recall that paper. We had a long strike in my industry in 52, you know, and I got acquainted with them, some of the family there. I remember Pearl O'Connor very well and Jim O'Connor. And I think Carl's mother's name was called Elise O'Connor. Hello?
Yeah, George. Yeah, so what type of paper was it, the Irish paper?
It would be, it was very broad-minded. It would be like against reaction of any kind, you know, against the McCarthyism of that kind, of that time. And we used to, I used to get the copies of the Irish paper at that time, and the United Irishman, they call it, and we used to get it run off together, myself and Puddle, and the printing place was around Water Street there at that time, and it helped both of us, because doing it together, like, we got a kind of a reduced rate.
George, now you've met Carol O'Connor. A lot of people are equating Carol O'Connor with a character he played, Archie Bunker. But, I mean, his politics couldn't have been further from the actual character.
His politics was totally different. He would be like, in his politics, he would be left or center. Like, he would be like the politics of the Kennedys or some Paul O'Dwyer, something like that. You know, and it was totally different from the characters he played. I don't know how many times I met Carol himself, you know, I have a very high opinion of all the family, you know, and whatever, you know, great memories of them. I think Pearl has gone a long time now, I guess so was Jim too, and Elise, but I think Carol's mother's name was Elise O'Connor.
George, when we think about Carol O'Connor, the thing that immediately comes to my mind is when he lost his son, George, to drugs.
Yes.
And there seemed to be a marked change in Carol O'Connor from then on.
Yes.
You remembered all the circumstances of that, George?
Yes, I do. He was pretty well shattered by it then, you know.
And also, the character Archie Bunker, it didn't originate here in America. There was a series over in England, and the character there was called Alf Garner. And I remember when I was living over in Ireland.
Yeah,
and Alf Garner would have made Archie Bunker look like a liberal with some of the stuff that he was doing over on the English version. So that was another sitcom that came over from London, and they adapted it for an American audience with American issues and American politics at the time. And it made, Red Fox was the same thing. That was Steptoe and Son, I think, out of England. It was the same type of comedy that came over. So we can remember that there was somebody called Alf Garner before there was an Archie Bunker. Well, we have about 20 minutes left here. I want to open up the phones here at WBAI. If you want to talk about Carol O'Connor and his impact on All in the Family, if you want to talk about Black Mass and about FBI informers, the number here is 212 209-2900. The number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. And you can speak on any of the topics we're talking about there today, from the fireman at the beginning of the show all the way now to Carol Ocando. WBAI, you're on the air.
How you doing? This is Adam on Root Form in Jersey. I'm from Manhattan, though. First time I listened to your show. Actually, no, it hasn't been the first time, but 10th time, I should say. First time I've called in. And I just want to say that Carol Ocana is one of my all-time favorites for being such a great humanitarian and being able to perform as his complete opposite on that show. And probably in the top 10 sitcom actors of all time. Would you agree on that?
Oh, I would say even higher than that. I mean, because it's just even playing the theme song there, it's just stuck in your head, that song.
Absolutely. He's a genius. He's in the vein of Jackie Gleason and the classic.
Another great Irish-American, Jackie Gleason.
You know what? The funny thing is, the two of them are my favorites of all time. And then a non-Irish actor I put in that class, like a Sherman Hemsley, just for being George Jefferson, you know. But I'll tell you, Carol O'Connor from In the Heat of the Night, all the way back to when he was doing little bits and pieces on TV shows. You know, I'm a little young. I don't remember seeing him, but I remember repeats of him on various 60s shows and movies that he played supporting roles in. And he's always been a hero, no doubt about it.
Yeah, well, George Jefferson got his start on All in the Family, too. That's
exactly.
What, that's where
so
he
just
started.
Shows you. Just shows you how powerful that show was. So, and that's all I want to say. And all else I want to say was ready for Rare for Mayor, hopefully. Thank you.
Well, from your lips to his
ears. You have no arguments for me.
Freddie's not going to argue
either. I think Freddie's the only logical choice we have in this city.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you this afternoon?
I'll let you know after the phone call.
All right. Very interesting point about Carol O'Connor. I guess I'm kind of a middle-of-the-road guy when it comes to politics. I root for the underdog. But of his acting career, he did study at the Abbey in Dublin, I believe. I could be wrong of that. And that he was also, after he portrayed generals twice in The Devil's Brigade and Kelly's Heroes, that when the producers of Patton were they had considered Rod Steiger, and I believe they had considered, correct me if I'm wrong, Kirk Douglas, they went to Carol O'Connor to portray the part as Patton, if anybody knew that.
No, I didn't, but that's pretty good information. I'm not a movie buff, but I like the story.
And he actually was supposed to be a very fine Shakespearean actor. That was where he went to Dublin to study. He had a lot of, was into his Irish roots, as I am. And basically, there's something else I was going to add. His mother, who passed away some years ago, who was a teacher, used to be in the St. Patrick's Day parade as one of the women jockeys. There's a horse riding procession that comes after the color guard passes, and there's some women, an equestrian team. Just a quick add notes, Jen. I'll let you go on to the next call.
Okay.
Have a very good day and very nice weekend.
Yes, thank you, too. WBAI, you're on the air. Number here is 212-209-2900. We have a full switchboard.
Yeah. Hold it there. Let me say one thing about WBAI there. Paul D. Rehan is just a new meathead.
Is that all you have to say?
Yeah, hold it. What's going to happen there now that I'm gone?
I think we'll carry on, Carol.
Listen, please bring back the old guys. I want Grandpa.
But Ethan, I thought you're still alive.
I want Grandpa. Yeah, you better bring back Grandpa. You understand that there?
Yes.
You want to hear Grandpa there.
Okay. Listen, Carol, thanks for checking in.
Yeah.
Listen, did you go up or down? All right, we lost that phone call. 212-209-2900. WBAI, you're on the air.
I was wondering why it is that the FBI insists on Great Britain's foreign policy implementing it. I mean, why is it, if we're a sovereign nation, we're seen to be working, or that the FBI, which is paid for by the American taxpayer, is doing the bidding of the British? Is there any reason? Is that advocated on some level by the American people, or was that just done by fiat?
This is all the close cooperation in fighting terrorism worldwide. And I want to tell you, listen to Democracy Now! On Monday. There'll be more about David Rupert, who's in protective custody here in America because he's testifying in a case over in Ireland. Has nothing to do with this country. He's being held here at taxpayers' dollars and protected.
And then not that any of us are coming to the defense of the FBI. The FBI is only the enforcement arm of the Justice Department. It's the United States Justice Department, the State Department, the federal government, all the way down the line that is doing Britain's bidding against Ireland.
212-209-2900. We have a full switchboard. Some of the phones are dropping off. I think after 20 rings, you drop off. But keep calling in. WBAR, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a question for Sandy Boyer. I've been impressed over the years by your talking about your involvement with the Irish Republican movement. I'd like to know, when did you first consider yourself a Republican, and what's being a Republican meant to you?
I first became politically involved with the Irish movement at the time of the Civil Rights Movement, because I'd been involved with the Civil Rights Movement here. I was Irish, had a strong sense of my Irish identity, but never did anything politically until that happened. And I've been deeply involved with a particular strain of the Republican tradition. The Republican tradition, like every other, is, they say, multi-splendored, and I would identify with the socialist element of that tradition. And to me, it means, of course, first and foremost, a completely independent republic, separate politically and, I would hope, economically from Britain. And I would hope a 32-county socialist republic where the working people owned it, controlled it, and ran it. But
democratic.
That would be certainly my own vision of that.
All right. Thank you, honey, all right, for that call. We'll get a little background on Sandy. 212-209-2900. WBAR, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
My name is Barney from Frimpin Little Neck.
Yes, go ahead, Barney.
For an old guy, I can't complain. Connection with the Sinn Féin victory in the north, they're 100% correct in doing what they did. Not under no circumstances hand over any more weapons. Otherwise, they'll bring back the Irish history into the 1920s when they had raving black and tans all over the place.
Well, Barney, I'm
yes.
going to tell you now, you can almost pick the date. They will be handing over the weapons very shortly. And what you're seeing this weekend is the ethnic cleansing that's going on.
I know that. I'm from that part of the country myself, but from Coleraine in County Derry.
Oh, well, you're in the heart of it there.
Exactly, yes.
Listen, what were your reminiscences of the marching season? I mean,
Nothing has changed, and it's getting worse, so it is. And the British government's 100% to blame for everything.
But did you ever feel that the July 12th, any affinity with it, with your Protestant neighbors or anything like that?
Well, actually, no, we weren't involved with that at all. But I remember when I was going to Catholic school in St. John's in Coleraine, they used to throw rocks at us, and then they used to say, here come the papers, here come the Fenians. And we used to walk to one side of the road, I walked 3 miles to school. And we thought nothing of it. I mean, it was just customary. And when it came to the 12th of July, two nights before, they had these big lamb bags. And you'd be awake all night listening to them, even though we lived outside the town of Coleraine. And we used to send milk to the creameries, 10 or 12 cans every day. And then towards the end, after the World War II, they used to put pebble stones in milk. When I go to the creameries, it was all condemned. And all the Orangemen did that.
Well,
and they discriminated against the Catholic business people. That's exactly who we were.
Yeah, I have to tell you, Barney, I almost read the exact same reports this past week about a Catholic school in the north of Belfast where the students and the parents were pelted
right.
by the loyalists. I mean, almost exactly what you're saying and what you're talking about.
But not to interrupt you, but yeah. By the same token, I had an uncle who addressed him, who was Lord Mayor of Coleraine, Dan McKenna. And I being Catholic, and actually being Catholic, he owned 3/4 of the town. And when he died, 3/4 of the town closed down. He was very well respected as a businessman. He never got involved in anything like that. But it paid them to be nice men, meaning them, the Orange Men. The Orange Men are, there's such a thing as an Orange Man, in those days we used to call the black men. They were known as the aristocratic Orange Men. They were called black men. That was August the 12th. That was their big day when they wore the black hats, the bowler hats.
Yeah, and this really had nothing to do with the color of the skin. It was the name
of
the...
Oh, no, of course not. That was the terminology we used in those days.
Yeah, that was the black preceptory.
Exactly, correct.
All right, listen, Barney, thanks for listening, and thanks for participating.
I always listen to you guys, and I'm so glad. Don't give up the weapons, because those blackheads, there's not a word about the Ulster crowd, the Orange Men, the Underground B-Specials. They have got arms all over the place.
I know, and the British Army...
Of course.
No one's asking them to give up their weapons.
Absolutely, that's the whole trucks of the war, and that's the whole thing right in a nutshell.
212-209-29.
Okay.
Thanks, Barney.
Bye.
From Great Neck. 212-209-2900, WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. Oh, boy, people are dropping off here. We're not cutting anyone off, they're just dropping off. BAI, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Steve from Mineola.
Steve.
A few weeks back, you had Francis McCauley on your program.
That's right.
And I spoke with her yesterday. And you just mentioned the stoning of the children on their way to the school. Francis got hit over the head with a brick. Ended up in the hospital.
We were wondering why she hasn't called us. Normally she calls, yeah.
It just happened the other night.
Right.
She has double vision in one eye. And she's going to the doctor Monday.
Well, I tell you one thing. We're going to have her on next Saturday then.
Yeah. Tell Francis, give her our best.
I'll give her a call.
Get in touch, and we'll get her on next week.
Okay, terrific. And the absorbers are going over starting next week. And many of them will be going up to the Springfield Road area.
I tell you one thing, things are heating up over there with the marching season coming up and the rioting that's going on every night there. So it's great to see that the observers are still going over.
Yes, we're going over starting Sunday, in fact.
Okay.
Okay.
Listen, we'll expect a report back from you when you get back.
Okay, terrific.
All right,
and as we speak of the marching season, we have a peculiar anniversary coming up here in New York. It's 130 years. Now, since the riots of 1871, the Orange Riots, this is when the National Guard came in and fired on the Catholics who were opposing the marching of the Orangemen in 1871. This is long after the Civil War. This is 5 years, 6 years after the Civil War. There was over 200 Irish people killed by the National Guard in those riots. This is the 130th anniversary of it coming up now on the 12th of July.
John, while we're talking about Carol O'Connor, I think there's something that's forgotten. I think it was forgotten on another show here. Carol O'Connor skillfully showed Archie Bunker as a bigot and exposed all those attitudes. That's what he was doing, and that's anybody who watched the show knew that that was what he was doing. And the message that came out of that show was the opposite, was that all this hatred and bigotry was wrong and slightly ridiculous, which is the worst thing you can do to that. When you make people look humorous and ridiculous, you just kill them politically.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, this is Astro called Chelsea. How you doing?
What's up, Astro?
Well, you know, there's no biography yet. It's called Madonna, an intimate biography about the love affair between John F. Kennedy and Madonna. And it talks about John F. Kennedy putting peanut butter and...
All right, how is this tying in to Carol... Astro, you're living up to your name, but how does this tie in with Carol O'Connor and everything?
Well, it's Irish history, you know. it's Irish history, John F. Kennedy Jr.
That's page 6 of the Post. 212-209-2900.
Hey, you guys.
Yes, what's up?
A great show. Listen, more on the FBI. There's a really good book called FBI Secrets by former agent Wesley Swearinger, and he talks about the whole process of cultivating too many informants.
Well, listen, as I said, listen to Democracy Now! On Monday between 9 and 10. We'll be talking about an informer within the Irish Freedom Committee out in Chicago, how he compromised some of the people out there, and how he'll be testifying in Dublin in a non-jury court against Mickey McKevitt, who is facing a life sentence. So we have an American citizen going over and testifying in a non-jury court being protected right now by Irish government somewhere in this country. 212-209-2900, WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, you're on.
Oh, John, it's Andy. Andy Norris here.
Oh, Andy, what's up? I've been reading some of your postings, lady,
on
the bulletin boards.
Well, I applaud you for having people phone in. It's good for you to do that. And I hope you can cover the Ardoyne and everything that's going on there.
No, we will. You heard some of the phone calls with the observers and everything on. We'll be having all of them on now.
But actually, the reason I call is about the FBI. It's interesting that Pacifica now is invoking the FBI. They're asking people on the national board to... they're basically collecting emails, letters, phone calls to forward them to the FBI. And it's kind of ironic that Pacifica, which was reviled, the FBI, which was reviled by Lou Hill, is now being called upon by Pacifica, and they're actually threatening RICO and things like that against what's basically an organized group of listeners and supporters. So.
Well, Andy, are you still with the local advisory board?
I am, actually.
All right. That's good. All right, keep listening and keep calling in, Andy, and I'll be looking for your postings up on the net.
Yeah, thanks very much, John.
All right, no problem. 212-209-2900. We'll take one more phone call here. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? Rocky Sullivan's tomorrow night having a benefit for student camping trip. The band Jaya is playing.
Okay.
I'm going to kick off the Summer Loves from 8 o'clock on. And it's for a camping trip that was taken in early March, late February, and took 21 special ed, emotionally disturbed children upstate. So I just wanted to remind you as you're going off.
No, listen, that's the way we're going to end it. Thank you for that. Rocky Sullivan does a lot of causes.
God bless him.
Yeah, you ain't kidding.
I just want to send our greetings out to George Harrison, because he has an anniversary coming up. It was a... This coming Tuesday is when he and the late Tom Falvey were arrested by the FBI. And I'm reminded of Tom, who, when people tried to come up to Tom on the picket lines and say, oh, you should be running guns, and then he said, I have other assignments. And, of course, those were classic words, and we want to remember Tom.
Remember, next week we'll be covering more on the David Rupert. Go to newshound.com tomorrow for some of the stories on the biography of David Rupert. Yes, Bernie.
And for everybody out there, you know, who remembers, you know, the good old days of radio, the FBI, it was Sunday night. The FBI was on every Sunday night. That's it was right. Sponsored by Lava Soap. I didn't see any difference between Lava Soap and the FBI. L-A-V-A. My God, how things have changed. I never thought, John, that I would be sitting here talking about the Federal Bureau of Investigation and what they're trying to do to us.
It's shocking. But this just in from the newsroom. The shout-out line will be running a little late today due to technical difficulties. T-Dove says, sorry about that, but that will be coming on. I have no doubt a tribute to John Lee Hooker will be coming up very shortly. And we want to send, once again, condolences out to all the firehouses that are listening to us, losing three brave men there during the week out in Queens, and to anybody in the O'Connor family out there in Queens. So for Radio Free Air, this is John McDonough.
Something inside so strong. Something inside so strong. The more you're up, you study my voice. The louder I will sing. You hide behind the walls of Jericho. Your life will come tumbling. Then I'm a pleasant time. You squander wealth, that's mine. My light will shine so bright it will blind you. Cause there's something inside so strong. I know that I can't make it. Cause you're doing me wrong, so wrong. And you talk about pride is gone. Oh, no, no, no. Something inside to show. Something inside to show. Brothers and sisters, when the instincts were just not good enough. But we know better. We're gonna look them in the eyes and we'll say, we're gonna do it anyway. We're gonna do it anyway. We're gonna do it anyway. Cause there's something inside so strong, so strong. I know that I can make it. Cause you're doing me wrong, so wrong. And you thought that my pride was gone, oh no.
Tune in to the Liquid Sound Lounge every Saturday from 6 to 9 p.m. with yours truly, DJ Jeannie Hopper, bringing you the underground music of the dance and DJ communities, globally united over WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City and streaming worldwide thanks to Porous.com. For playlists and how to submit material for possible airplay, log on to LiquidSoundLounge.com. Don't miss the show every Saturday, 6 to 9 p.m., right here at 99.5 FM, WBAI, New York City.
Johnny Hammond.